Christoph Cox is a professor of philosophy at Hampshire College and a faculty member at the Center for Curatorial Studies, Bard College. He's the author of Nietzsche, Naturalism and Interpretation from the University of California Press, and co-editor of Audio Culture, Readings in Modern Music. The recipient of the 2009 Arts Writers Grant from Creative Capital Warhol Foundation, Cox is editor-at-large at Cabinet Magazine and writes regularly for Art Forum, The Wire, and other publications. He is currently compiling a philosophical book about sound art and experimental music.
Thanks a lot to Kelly for inviting me here and for you all to coming. I've been asked to give a talk about Max Neuhaus, right, who's represented in this museum by one piece in two parts. The one piece is probably the most overlooked, which may be a bad term, piece in the entire museum. It's a piece that happens once an hour for 7 minutes. Around the museum. It's an invisible piece, it's an audio piece, so it's very easy to miss. And there's a brief drawing where we initially started. There's a brief drawing that Neuhaus started to do in the late 90s. He started to make drawings of his works just to kind of give them some kind of physical presence. Of course, sound is a physical presence too, but to give them some visual presence. So I want to do a couple things. I want to talk mostly about this piece, but I want to talk about it. I want to contextualize it a little bit. So I'm going to be giving a bit of a more of a sort of gallery talk than a gallery walk or tour. But we're going to be moving around a little bit, fairly close by here. I thought this would be a good place, not because John Chamberlain's work has a lot to do with Max Neuhaus's work, but just because it's nice and light. If people want to interrupt me, ask questions, people want to sit down, people want to whatever, fine, right? So just a quick bit of, I'll say quickly something about the piece to begin with, and then hopefully we'll talk for a while, and then we'll go hear the piece at the top of the hour. I used to wear a watch. I don't wear a watch anymore because I have a phone, but I don't want to hold my phone. So anyway, if somebody, maybe Kelly, can remind me at like 10 minutes to the hour, we'll sort of walk there. But so this piece, Timepiece Beacon, is one of a few, one of a group of what Neuhaus called timepieces or moment pieces or place pieces that he produced over the course of maybe 25 years or so. And they're, each one of them is quite different from the other, but each one of them has a particular component. That is, each one of them marks time by having a slow crescendo of sound that abruptly stops at the time it wants to mark. Sometimes that's 15 minutes after the hour, sometimes it's the top of the hour, sometimes it's, you know, various temporal configurations, but always always to mark time in some way. So this piece functions as a kind of clock in some way, right? It's called the timepiece, and we tend not to use that term timepiece anymore, but I guess fancy watchmakers still use it to refer to a watch, right, to a clock. It's a piece that, something that records time or that notes time. And so I want to talk today, the pieces I want to point out and the context in which I want to put Neuhaus's work is all in the context of thinking about time in contemporary art, and particularly thinking about time in the context of the work here at Dia Beacon. I'm going to say just a couple things by way of background biography of Neuhaus, only because I think it's important to situate these pieces. So Neuhaus started his work as a musician, grew up outside of New York City, began taking drums in New York City with a great big band drummer, Gene Krupa, and was something of a childhood prodigy. He started performing with John Cage and Cage's the sort of New York school composers around John Cage in New York while he was still a teenager. Went to college, encountered a bunch of experimental music, began to perform a number of works, complexly realized works, sometimes using electronics to excite percussion instruments. After he graduated from college, went on tour with Karlheinz Stockhausen, one of the sort of reigning great masters of modern music, and really became known as the guy to record and perform percussion music, which had become increasingly important in the 50s, right, when composers were kind of looking to sort of move away from move away from things like melody and harmony and interested in things like texture. And so percussion music became actually quite prominent, and Newhouse became the guy to do this. So in 1968, he recorded recorded a record for Columbia Masterworks, back when Columbia and other such record companies still had weird music on vinyl. Recorded these pieces that he'd been working on for a long time, and then decided not to play music ever again. If I were doing a PowerPoint, I'd show you the fantastic record cover for this. He was Newhouse in this kind of like late 60s, you know, long hair, scruffy beard, bare-chested, you know, kind of standing there with all these percussionists around. It's really quite a sight. But anyway, he stopped making music largely because he had become disinterested in the kind of time that music required. The kind of time it organized, right? So a musical piece is something that for some set amount of time, let's say 20 minutes, 10 minutes, marks out time in a certain way, organizes it, fills it, and at concerts which begin at a certain time, they end at a certain time. So music is something that really kind of organizes and charts time, and does it in what Newhouse thought was a very constrictive way. And he got to be interested in another way of using sound, and another way of thinking about sound. I'll talk a little bit about the sort of durational aspects in a moment. But what Newhouse was interested in is trying to develop pieces over a very long period of time that allowed viewers or listeners to kind of enter into them and exit them. What he said when he started doing sound installations, and Newhouse was the guy who sort of coined the term sound installation, a term that's become quite prominent over the past, you know, couple decades. What he said was that, quick quotation, he said the important idea about this kind of work, and he was talking about one of his sound installations, is that it's not music. It doesn't exist in time. I've taken sound out of time and I've made it into an entity. Now, of course, that's not quite right, because any sound requires time. Any sound takes up time, right? That's if someone were to tell you, yeah, I made this great sound piece, it doesn't take up any time. I mean, you might think of it solely as an idea, but sound requires duration, okay? And I think that what he's doing in marking this shift from time to space, from music to sound installation, is he's trying to mark two different conceptions of time. I think another thing he was trying to do is to say, I'm more interested in what sculptors do with a particular space than in what musicians do with a particular time, right? And so he was moving from one to the other. Now, I'm going to talk about a bunch of notions of time along the way, and we'll look at them and experience them too along the way too. In 1958, John Cage, one of the sort of central heroes of post-war American music, gave a lecture in which he talked about two notions of time. He said, on the one hand, there are time objects. And time objects, he was thinking of the ordinary musical work, a musical work that has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. It develops in time, it organizes time in a certain way, it carves up time. And Cage was saying, I'm no longer interested in that kind of time. I'm interested in another notion of time. And the other notion of time that he contrasted to this is what he called purposeless processes, right? And this notion of time is an open-ended time, right? It's a time that's indeterminate. And we can think of this, and I'm going to draw on a couple notions in sort of physics and chemistry very, very, very briefly. We can think of the time object as a kind of a closed system, right? It organizes time in a certain way. One tries to leave out kind of distracting elements, whereas purposeless processes are kind of open systems in which things are kind of circulating throughout that. Cage and Newhouse were very interested in installing work or thinking about music in the sense in which it could exist with other kinds of auditory activities. Cage started to think about this notion of music, and for those of you who know the history of music, especially experimental music over the course of the 60s, all sorts of musicians were developing these notions of time, were developing music along with these notions of time. So Morton Feldman, for example, was creating, actually this is somewhat later, but was creating works that lasted hours, right? And his idea was that in a work that lasts hours, you're not going to try to keep track of the shape of the piece. What you're going to do is be in it, right? And it's going to sort of carry you along. Steve Reich made a number of pieces that and musical minimalism in general that sort of carried on in principle indefinitely, right? Or Reich made a couple tape pieces, for example, in which certain events are sort of let loose and they carry on again in principle indefinitely. And we're going to see that this connects to a number of pieces around here as well. One more thing about this notion of time, and then we'll shift and start talking about some work. These two notions, this notion of time as time objects and purposeless processes, are what Henri Bergson, at the very end of the 19th century, made a contrast between time and duration, le temps and la durée. Right? Again, these are similar kinds of notions that started developing in post-war sound and music. On the one hand, there's the time of the clock. And we're going to come back to this because I want to talk about clocks with regard to the Neuhaus piece. We're going to talk about clocks and calendars later. But clock time, especially when we think of the old sort of analog circular clock, organizes time in a circular way, organizes moments side by side, places them side by side, contiguous with one another but not overlapping one another, and time is kind of spatialized. One thinks of the hands of a clock as moving through time. Okay, so this notion of time as clock time is about number, it's about measure, and it's also about clock time tends to measure things that are on the outside of it, right? We say, how long did that race take? You know, Usain Bolt took, however, 9.64 seconds to cross the finish line, right? So that clock time marks time from without. The other notion of time that Bergson wanted to contrast this was duration. Duration we can think of duration as being sort of in time, as time being. Bergson has a great example. He says, think of clock time as watching a point move along a line from the outside. Now think of duration as being that point along the line, right? In other words, a time in which past, present, and future are continuous with one another. It provides a kind of continuous flow. And initially, Bergson thought that we could think of this as human conscious time versus sort of objective time in the world, but he came to think that everything in the world has its own duration. Okay, it's important to think of duration for Bergson, because if we think about clock time, if we think of time as space, right, as the spatialized notion, time doesn't pass, right? Because one moment can't dislodge something else if it's sitting spatially next to one another. So duration is required a kind of interpenetration of moments in order for time to pass at all. Now, these two notions of time we find really nicely encapsulated in Cage's most famous composition, 4 minutes and 33 seconds. If anybody knows anything about Cage, they know about 4 minutes and 33 seconds, and you usually think, oh, that's totally boring, I know what it is, right? People are required to sit there for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, and all that happens is silence, and right? They think of it as a kind of conceptual piece. But Cage thought of it as a really physical piece. No, actually sit there for 4 minutes and 33 seconds and listen, right? So what we get in 4 minutes and 33 seconds is two things. On the one hand, we get clock time, right? The piece is called 4 minutes and 33 seconds. It lasts that long. Cage also noted that time and space are really connected here. He said, if you want, you can call it 4 feet 33 inches. Same thing, right? Time and space. But what Cage's piece does, actually, is it uncovers a very different notion of time. For that brief window in time, right, for that brief moment, time, that piece allows in duration. It allows in the time of the world. It allows in the sounds of the world and the temporality of the world through which we live. Enters into that window for that amount of time, right? So Cage is contrasting these two things within that piece itself. I think Neuhaus is doing something similar in his pieces as well. I want to talk quickly about in a moment about two of Neuhaus's pieces, and I want to talk about them in relationship to some visual art here. And I want to do this quickly by way of a famous essay that those of you who have done any work in art theory will surely have read, and those of you who don't, I'll quickly summarize it. This is Michael Fried's famous piece, Art and Objecthood, in which that piece, Fried is a modernist critic, and he's criticizing what he's seeing coming up in the 1960s. He's criticizing essentially everything that shows up in this museum, right? And what he's, his claim is that there are two very different temporal ideas going on. And he's for one of them and he's against another. And I want to sort of flip that. But what Fried is interested in, he said the modernist work of art, or even the traditional work of art, everything is there in the piece itself, right? In other words, that piece is a composition, it's a totality, and all the parts relate to one another internally, so that one could, in principle, stand in front of a painting or a sculpture. Sculptures are more difficult because they're three-dimensional, tend to be. But take a painting, one could grasp it as a totality. One could, the painting absorbs one in its own in its own composition, in the totality of elements. And Fried thought of this as a kind of liberation from ordinary time. One of the reasons he thought that we went to a museum, we stood in front of paintings, is to liberate us from ordinary, everyday, mundane time, which just goes on and on and on and on and on. Maybe you could say the same thing about traditional pieces of music. One of the reasons why we're interested in traditional pieces of music, pieces with beginnings, middles, and ends, is that we want time to be organized for us in that kind of way. What Fried thought was going on in so much of the work of the 1960s, and that's represented here at Dia Beacon, is a different notion of time. It's a notion of time that that involves what he and Bergson called duration. I was thinking that we could look at the Judd boxes, which I didn't realize weren't installed here, but there are a couple other pieces right around the corner that we can sort of see this happening. Let me just quickly say it, and then we'll walk over and look at the Richard Serra piece, I thought, actually. What Fried thought was going on with these, with the minimalist work of the 60s and so much other work, was that it engaged with the viewer's body in a certain way, so that it was impossible to take in at a glance. One had to sort of move around it, and the piece would, in a certain sense, shift and change with the viewer's movements and with the viewer's relationship to the object. Fried famously called this theatrical because he thought that these pieces were kind of playing to the human body instead of being there. So the modernist work of art doesn't care in a way about you, right? So Fried wanted to say. It draws you in, maybe, and you are part of its temporality. But the minimalist work engages you and wants you to sort of have your experience unfold in time. Let's take a look at the Richard Serra piece. One of the we can see when we walk around that piece, you can see in a way you can't capture it, you can't glance it. One of the reasons why I wanted to look at the Judd boxes is that they're serial. In a certain sense, they could go on forever. So that the Serra piece doesn't have that kind of seriality, but it does have this kind of monumentality that doesn't allow us to grasp it. So this is a later piece by Richard Serra, but it has some of the features. It has some of the features that Fried was so, let's say, annoyed with in the mid '60s when he wrote his piece, and that's that a sculpture like this, a piece like this, is kind of impossible to get one's head and one's body around without physically moving around the piece. And even when you physically move around the piece, which I encourage you to do, its contours and its totality, what the 60s sculptors like Robert Morris called its gestalt, is not easy to take in a single grasp, right? It requires your time. And if you think about the four sort of circular, semicircular, spiral pieces by Richard Serra down the stairs, we'll go down there when we go out to hear the piece. those also require require a kind of time, require a kind of duration that's very different from the sculpture that one could grasp in a single moment, okay? And so to begin, I'm gonna use this as just the quickest of examples. I said that I wanted to, if we go around the corner, we're not gonna do this now because it will take us too long to sort of walk around this labyrinthine museum, but the Donald Judd work in there that has a kind of serial form in which sometimes they're identical pieces that are repeated multiple times, sometimes they're variations on a particular structural theme, generally a box of some sort. Those pieces, that repetitive, that serial form, that repetitive nature, was also something that Fried thought really kind of engaged this notion of duration, this notion of time as simply continuing on and continuing on infinitely. And you think if those of you who know, you know, minimalist music, or those of you listen to house or techno or something like that, know that those musics that involve a kind of repetitive structure, they can never sort of encompass themselves within a total frame, right? In a way, they go on and on. As Judd said about his work, it's just one thing after another, right? And so I think Fried is right in describing the art of the 60s in this way, but I think that I'm so much more interested in those, in works that involve duration. And so much of the sound artwork, particularly Newhouse's sound artwork, involves duration in that way. So Newhouse started to do a bunch of sound installations in various places. He did them in subway stations. He did them in swimming pools. He did them in corridors of various sorts. And all of them, they tended to involve continuous sound. They tended to involve drones. And we can talk about drones later if you want. But a number of artists at the time started to use drones. Lamont Young, who also was sponsored by Dia and whose great Dream House in New York City is a constant drone piece. Alvin Lussier used drones a number of times. Drones and repetitive pulses tended to be the figures. And why is that? Well, because those things, with repetition and with the drone, one stops in a way listening for the shape of the piece. And one finds oneself sort of in the piece and sort of moving along in the kind of moment-to-moment drift of the piece rather than trying to encompass it in some kind of shape. So Newhouse started to make installations of all sorts, and in 1973 he came across this space in Times Square that he thought this would be a perfect place to locate a sound installation. After years of haggling with the city, he finally put a big loudspeaker down there with some homemade electronics set up to produce a kind of rich harmonic drone, got permission from the city to do this, and installed this continuous piece in Times Square in New York City between 45th and 46th Street on Broadway. It's an unmarked piece. It was initially installed in 1977, was there until about 1992 when it kept on breaking down and Newhouse wasn't in the country and said forget about it. But then it was reinstalled in 2002 with the help of Dia, and it's still existing there. And it broadcast this rich kind of harmonic drone from underneath the subway grate. It's entirely unmarked. You won't, there's nothing that says this is an art piece by Max Newhouse. You come across it or you don't. And Newhouse was fascinated and interested in the idea that you could pass through this and say, wow, that was sort of cool, in the way that you would pass through something, you know, when you're walking down the street and you sort of pass through a blast of hot or even better in summer cool air, and you know, there's a sort of slight sort of dislocation in your experience. Newhouse wanted that piece to serve that way, wanted it to draw in the sounds around it, but also make a slight sort of dislocation. He called the piece, he said he wants the sound to be impossible, but almost plausible, right? So it's like it's not right, like this sound shouldn't be coming here, but it's almost plausible, like it almost could be here. And it's very, very easy to miss. I know loads of people who work around Times Square, whatever, had no idea there was a piece there. So that was one piece in 1977. And Times Square, I think of, it happens to be located in Times Square, but I actually think the piece should be taken literally and not just as the designation of a place. I think we can think of it, you know, putting an apostrophe in there, as Times Square, as in a way that this it's not actually a square, it's kind of a, I don't know what it is. It's a triangular quadrilateral. That's what it is, right? So from this piece, we can think of it like what Cage does with time, four minutes and 33 seconds, Newhouse does with space. He locates this space that one could pass through or not, and there's this continuous sound that draws in the ambient environment, okay? Now I wanna move into another room. I wanna talk about one last set of pieces before we can, depending on what the time is, we can go hear the Newhouse piece. We can have a little bit of Q&A. But I wanna talk about the relationship between clocks and calendars, because that's what we're and how they organize time. Musical pieces organize time, artworks organize time, clocks and calendars organize time. So let's move back. We're more or less back where we came from, the room right next door, the Ankawara room. So I wanted to think about, as I said, that Timepiece Beacon, this piece that will that's sort of the focal point for the talk. Timepiece Beacon is a sort of a clock, and I wanted us to think about the ways in which we have these sort of technological features that organize time, clocks and calendars, and I wanted us to start to think about them, and I think that the Kawara piece, the Kawara series, the series called Today, gives us a kind of entryway into Timepiece Beacon. A clock, right, as we, as I said, sort of organizes time in a kind of circular way. Clocks figure time as a circle, right? The same, you know, 2:31 shows up, well, twice a day. And the history, if we think, historical time tends to figure time as a line. So we have these two notions, time as a circle, time as a line, which are pretty ordinary in our everyday lives. We use these things, right? History, we tend to think of events as happening on a line, not repeating, or if they repeat, they repeat in a sort of different way. Calendars, and however, you know, many ways of physically laying out a calendar, but calendars are a kind of cross between the time and the line. On the one hand, between the circle and the line. On the one hand, they're circular, in the sense that days, weeks, and months repeat, right? Days every 7, months every 12, etc. Right? They repeat, and yet the year carries on that linear function. So we can think of a calendar as, in a way, a kind of spiral, right? It doubles back on itself, but it constantly moves forward. So one has a birthday, right? And that birthday is the same day every year, and yet the years move on, right? So this piece on Kawara's Today series, which he's been doing since 1966, is a kind of calendar, right? It organizes time in a certain way, but in a very peculiar way. So the rules for this piece, the rules that Ankawara gave himself in 66 when he started to do this, is that the dates on these paintings, each of them hand-painted, the dates on these paintings are the days on which they were painted. Okay? Each time Kawara goes to paint a painting, he mixes the colors himself, mixes them anew. Paints several layers of that of color on the surface. He marks the date by hand, without a stencil. It's done by hand. The format of the date corresponds to the particular location in which he is at a particular time. And if he was in Japan or Korea or China, something that doesn't use this format, he tended to use Esperanto as the mode. But so each one of these marks a particular place and marks a particular time. But it's a very peculiar calendar, right? Because most of the dates are missing. The crucial thing, if the painting isn't finished on the day in which he begins to paint it, he discards it, right? So it's only the only paintings that are retained are the paintings in which that painting was completed on that particular day. And you have to imagine, days are taken up with various activities, and these paintings actually take a certain amount of time. They're various layers. They're sanded in between. The date is painted over the bottom layer, etc. So it takes a certain amount of time. And there are variations too in this, right? So, but again, it's a calendar in which most of the pieces are, most of the elements, most of the days are disappeared, right? So it's a calendar of particular kinds of moments. I think of it as a calendar of what mathematicians call singularities, right? It's a calendar of singularities. And when the term singular means lots of things, but in the mathematical context, a singularity is a point at which the inflection of a curve changes. So if you think of a square, for example, a square has four singularities, right? Four points at which there's an alteration of the line, right? Right? Changes at the corner. And an infinite number of ordinary points. So the mathematical distinction is between singular points and ordinary points. This calendar is a calendar of singularities. It's a calendar of specific moments, specific dates in which something unusual took place, right? And the rest of the time in between these things, one thinks, well, I don't know, went on, lived an ordinary life, didn't paint a painting, nothing particular, at least artistically, at least for this series, happened in Kawara's life, right? I think there are a couple different things going on in this kind of calendar. It marks time, marks regular time, but it marks unique moments in time. Okay, to start thinking about Timepiece Beacon, where we'll go in a moment we don't have control over when we, this is one of the temporal things about this piece, we don't have control about when we hear the piece. The piece starts at 7 minutes to the hour, and we'll be there or we won't. But we'll go there. But I want to, on the one hand, so to shift to think about Max Neuhaus's piece, on the one hand, that piece is a simple clock, right? It marks time. It marks the top of every hour. Yet I think there's something unusual about that particular clock. It doesn't do so in the ordinary manner in which bells happen, right? It does so in a peculiarly inverted way. But before I talk about the particular mode I want to do it, I want to think about one other way of marking time that's a common feature throughout, a lot of cultures, but certainly a European culture. And that's the time of bell ringing, right? So those of you who, spend any amount of time, in my small town in Massachusetts, we have this too. In the ordinary European town, the clock strikes at the top of an hour, and one hears it and one marks time in that way. But there's a traditional practice of bell ringing that's not just about marking that kind of time, that's not just about marking the hours, but that's about marking unique events, so that baptisms or weddings or funerals are marked by the ringing of a bell. And so bell ringing in that sense marks singularities, marks singular time rather than just the ordinary routine, homogeneous time of clocks. And so I think that those two things are going on in Neuhaus's piece. One of the things, there's a really wonderful book about bells, about the sound of bells, called Village Bells. It's by a French anthropologist, sociologist called Alain Corbin. And he talks about how the fact that the practice of bell ringing and using bells to mark these singular moments is actually older than, and in some ways in competition with, the way in which we tend, in competition with clock time. with that regular, homogeneous, every hour time is marked, right? So bell ringing has this strange duality, in a way maybe like Cage's 4 minutes into 33 seconds, in a way like Kawara's calendar, where there are two things going on at once. On the one hand, a marking of regular time, on the other hand, a marking of kind of singular or extraordinary time. And so what Newhouse's piece, for in all the time, in almost all of his sound installations, certainly in Times Square and certainly in Dia Beacon, he's interested in these drones. And when he's asked to describe these drones, he's always said, I like to refer to them as kind of the after ring of large bells, right? So if you know, the striking of a bell has a couple features. Musicologists or audiologists or those who study sound, think of it, there's an attack and there's a decay, right? The bells have a very sharp attack, right? The bell has a stroke, and it's very sharp, and then those bells are big and metallic, and they ring for some time afterwards, and they slowly decay. So bells are marked by, and each instrument, each room is marked by a different kind of attack and decay. They're marked by a certain what's called an envelope, a sound envelope. So Newhouse has been working with these kinds of bell sounds for a long time, and so what we find in Timepiece Beacon is the inverse of the ordinary bell ring. Where the bell ring has a sharp attack and a slow decay, Timepiece Beacon has a very, very slow, you can't even call it an attack, but it's a piece that gradually builds over the course of 7 minutes, and at the top of the hour, suddenly that sound is pulled away. Suddenly the sound is drawn away. And what I think the piece does, and what sort of Newhouse described it as doing, is that piece takes its time in developing. It draws sound into it, draws the ambient sound into it. It's very Newhouse, like Cage and like so many other experimental composers and sound artists, are interested in the fact that ambient sound is drawn into their pieces, right? So that the piece is almost, you know, it's when you're listening for it, when you go out there and you listen for it, it takes a while to start to hear it. And often, even, you know, I've heard this piece many times, and I'll begin to hear it, and I'll think, no, that's the rumble of the air conditioner, or that's an airplane going overhead. That's the low rumble of an airplane, right? And so the piece, you can sort of mistake it, and it gradually builds. And once you hear it, you can sort of really, if you're listening for it, you can really pay attention to it. And you can hear, it's a kind of wavering drone. And it does have a kind of musicality that's different from ordinary, the drones of the HVAC system, which, you know, on top of the building, which you can hear as well. And then when it cuts out, it does something quite extraordinary. It's very subtle, and I don't mean to say that it's this colossal event, but it's very subtle. It does something kind of extraordinary. It sort of momentarily sort of heightens that ambient noise. So all the noise that was kind of collected around it becomes sort of amplified or heightened or clarified, sometimes only for a brief moment. And you also tend to hear the bell, I think, to hear that sound after it's stopped. There's a sort of aural after image to it as well. I sometimes compare this piece to listening to dub reggae. This is maybe something that, you know, listening to Max Neuhaus and dub reggae maybe doesn't have, you know, but so one of the great things about what dub did, what dub producers did in the early 70s, is they took ordinary, they'd take a reggae single, and producers like Lee Scratch Perry or King Tubby would, they'd take the piece and they would, you know, all of a sudden drop out the vocal or drop out the guitar piece. And they'd leave these kind of cavernous spaces, right? And so something kind of odd happens. I don't know if it's sort of cognitively or orally when those things happen. And dub producers were constantly playing with cutting away sounds, with what it means to cut away sounds, to add and subtract them. And I think Newhouse is doing the same thing, albeit in a very different way. With this piece, he's I think of it somehow as sort of dubbing the environment, right? So, or environmental sound or ambient sound, draws all these sounds in there and then drops it out. And what happens when it's dropped out is something is amplified and heightened, and you have that that sort of extraordinary experience. And again, it's subtle, right? It's not the kind of thing where like you're walking, you're like, ah, that's the end of the Newhouse piece, must be, you know, 3 o'clock. It doesn't happen that way. It's a piece that you have, it's like the Times Square piece, where you come across it and you might experience it or you might not. So how are we doing with time?
Just a couple minutes to 2.
Okay. Okay. We can start walking over there. If people have any questions they want to ask along the way. Is the Lawler piece too, is the Lawler piece kind of intrusive there or not so much? Let's go there.
Okay.
Yeah. So one of the other things about this piece is that its space is kind of indeterminate. That is, it's not clear where it's coming from. I mean, I've never been allowed to, you know, climb on the roof to figure it out. But the museum just says it happens around the museum, and it's true. You can hear it from most cases, but. I don't know where its physical location is, but again, you know, it's physically, I think that's part of what Newhouse is interested in, that the physical location of it is kind of not very important. It takes place, it happens in a kind of sort of general ambient way. If there are any questions or thoughts or yeah?
Are you going to go talk about the drawing?
Yeah, I wasn't going to talk about the drawing, but I can. Newhouse's drawings are quite elegant. They're things that he started to do, as I said, at the end of the 90s. He had been producing sound installations for years before he started to document them in these ways. And all the drawings are up on Newhouse's website. You can go and you can find PDFs of all of these drawings. And each one of them is quite different. They're very simple. This one is very simple. It just has they're all pencil drawings. And this one just shows a gradual sort of a sound envelope, a sort of increasing sound envelope that ends. Others of them, an early piece called. A stairwell in Ryerson University, for example, just shows that stairwell, a schematic of the stairwell, and it's colored in various sections of the stairwell are colored. So he tends to think of sound as sort of coloring a space, which is a fairly common way for musicians to talk about sound color, talk about sounds as Brian Eno, when he was talking about his early ambient music, talked about scent, right? Talked about he wanted his music to fill a space like the way that a perfume would fill a space, right? It fills it in a kind of diffuse way. You're sure that it's there, but you don't, you know, it doesn't have a particular location. So Newhouse's drawings tended to do that same thing. Tended to kind of use color to represent differences in sound texture or differences in sound timbre. Yeah. Well, it depends what you're after. In a way, I mean, I remember. I think I sometimes refer to different musical practices or artistic practices, and there are limits to this, so you know, take it as far as it goes, but to games, right? In other words, so if you think of the difference between baseball and basketball and football, let's think about soccer, basketball, and lacrosse, right? Okay? Those are three ways of getting balls in particular in holes or nets or whatever, right? And so in a way, there's something that makes them all games. And yet, the rules of those games are totally different, and they're different ways of playing them. And in a way, you have to know, when someone says, I think baseball's so boring, you have to say, no, but this is what's interesting about it, or whatever, right? So and I think that the game that Reich is playing is different from the game that, you know, that Keith Moon is playing, right? And so one has to kind of learn what that game is. And I think what these guys are interested in, again, it's a different conception of time. And it's a conception of time that it's a different way of organizing time. And I think this piece will, yeah. You'll start to hear. I should shut up, actually, but that's not it. That's a train. A kind of immersive sense of time versus a more structured notion of time, I think. But let's see. I should say quickly that I'm not actually sure that Newhouse was sort of interested in having a bunch of people out here, like, you know, listening carefully for it. But it's just to say that, you know, so you can do whatever the hell you want as far as sound goes. But one way to do this is to listen to it. It's just to listen to it as a piece. But you don't have to, right? Pretty easy to miss if you don't. But that's right. Yeah. Yeah. But you don't know whether the train's on time. This thing is always on time. The train isn't always on time. The train sort of no, it's okay. That's the brakes, you know. That's life.
It was something that was considered, I think.
Yeah. No, I know.
The train schedule had a bit to do.
Yeah. So that particular, you know, the train sort of ruined, let's say, the dramatic effect, which is, you know, it's a subtle drama. Of the ending, but again, I think he thinks that's part of it. And one of the great things about what I think just happened, I mean, I'll tell you from my perspective, you can tell me from yours, is that the train sort of washed that over. And so when you're done, you're like, is it happening? Is it going? And then also in you heard the train, you heard the whistles earlier on. And I was just to come back really quickly to your question. You know, there are various ways of organizing sound. you know, for the past couple centuries, European music has tended to organize it by the tonic, right? By a particular pitch to which other pitches circulate. Other musics tend to organize sound around a line, around a drone. And you know, even not even we don't even have to go outside of European music. If you think of the bagpipe, for example, which is some people's least favorite instrument in the world, it's one of my favorites. But it's right there's that single drone, and the pipe portion of the backpack of the bagpipe sort of goes around that. And I think that so when the train just went by there, I think. So there's that drone, and what the train whistle did for me is it sort of drew that drone down. Like it's almost like it's like a magnet, right? It goes, you know, the drone sort of waves, it gets bent down in the way that a magnet would make something sort of, you know, swerve or bend, which I thought was super cool. Anyway.
Is there any harmonic relationship between the train whistle? Because the train whistle is a certain chord.
Yeah. I know that when it was designed very much as Kelly said in relationship to the train, so I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's
sounded kind of related.
Totally. Yeah, exactly.
It hasn't been like specifically documented, but it has been alluded to.
Yeah. I mean, one of the difficulties of, I approach this not as an art historian, but as a philosopher, but if, you know, I know, there are people doing art historical work on Max Neuhaus. He was incredibly cagey about his, I mean that in the ordinary sense of cagey, about, you know, so if you ask him questions about, like, you know, was this, he would give me the most vague answer. So I'm sure if you were asked directly, he would say, like, you would either say no, or you would say like, you know, something like, "Yeah, I might have considered that," or something like that. You know, but you wouldn't get a straight answer. So you just have to sort of say yes. It, you know, I heard it. It's there. Yeah. Other things, people should feel free to. But quite subtle, and it doesn't. It's hard to say because it's so imbricated with environmental sound, but those pitches bend and swerve, but they don't markedly depart from their line. You know, from there. Yeah.
I noticed this high pitched sound that might be cricket or cicada or something.
Yeah.
During the piece, I turned to my friend and I was like, "Is that in the piece?"
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell.
Right.
And now
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'll get checked out. But I think that it's interesting that, like, when you said it draws an ambient sound, I'm kind of like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
It harmonizes.
Or at least it becomes like, as you said, it's like not totally distinguishable from it. You know, like is that. You know, I mean, we know that there's a train track there, and we know what a train whistle sounds like, so we're not really confused there. But even when we're not confused, I think we can think like, that's that.
And
yeah.
So why did you choose to put it on the hour if it's about creating a certain duration instead of tying it to this mechanical clock? Because now it's predictable anyway.
Yeah.
We can come here
exactly
on the hour,
and we can listen to it. Yeah.
Listen to it.
Most of the other pieces that he did, most of the other installations were continuous, right? So they were pieces that would go on. There's Louise Lawler again. which I can mention in a second. But it's true. It's peculiar. I mean, I think again, my sense. I mean, the way I read that is an effort to, on the one hand, acknowledge the clock, but also slightly like swerve clock time in the same way that the Ankawara piece wants to acknowledge the calendar and yet also make a kind of tweak or in calendar time. I think he was also just interested in. I think he's also just really interested in bells and the fact that bells mark time. At a museum like this, I mean, I don't know, I suppose one could mark, bells tended to mark events in a community, which, I mean, Beacon's a community, but I don't know if Dia is exactly, you know, it could mark all the, you know, Kelly's done with lunch, or whatever. But yeah, so it is peculiar in that way. But again, I was trying to point out these various things, like Cage is 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which is so much about clock time in some ways, all registered by a clock, and yet it's interested in something else. You know, these things that are on the one hand, they give a gesture to the kind of very structured time, yet they pull it back too.
And it's important to know, we only brought you out here as a way to sort of gather the group.
Yeah.
But it's audible from inside the museum.
Yeah.
And outside.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's sort of immersive, whether you're in the exterior or the interior of the museum, which is something to know. It's not just to experience the perimeter, but as well as outside.
Yeah. Yeah, I've really liked to listen to it from the front courtyard. Hear people going in and out, you can hear the cafe. You can hear the HVAC system. Yeah. This is. Yeah. I'm happy to hang around and talk to people, answer questions, or converse with people. Otherwise, feel free to split. Thanks for coming along, and yeah.
Oh, my pleasure.